Most people never stop to consider the history of the language they speak, just as they never ponder the geology of the ground they stand on.
Here we are, another episode, another special episode. What are we doing today?
This is a special about philology, yes. Which we've talked about before, and we felt like it was important to give a little bit more backstory about philology, because yeah. This is something Tolkien was, it was really important to Tolkien.
Well, I mean, we've tried to highlight that, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, originally I thought maybe we could do this in some of the elf chapters or something from Fellowship, but like all the chapters are so packed. And then also I kind of thought, why don't we try to do like one special episode at the end of each book? It's a real cap to it too, you know, a little bonus. So this is the one for the end of the book 2 of the Fellowship of the Ring. And yeah, I had a bunch of notes, covered a lot about it in the Tolkien books that I was reading. So I figured we should really do this justice, and we just have enough material to just make it its own special here, so I thought we should go for it. So we'll explain what philology is. We'll cover like the history of the study of it, because it started pretty intensely about 100 years before Tolkien. And then we'll talk about Tolkien as the philologist, but then we'll also talk about how Tolkien took his philology and his authorship for all of his Middle-earth creations.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, and there's no Cliff's Notes, so I guess we just gotta start. Do you want to sum up this however many page outline? Just kidding.
Or would Cliff's Notes be summarizing the history of philology?
Oh, well, I mean, isn't that, well,
no, it'd be too much to summarize. Regardless,
yeah, I don't think it would. Okay, so like Clifford said in that opening quote, you know, most people don't think of the history of the language that they're speaking right now. From what I gathered from reading the books, it sounds like Romans recognized that Latin and Greek had words that sounded similar. And so then from like the centuries after that, people kept tabs on it, you know, like, like all the Romance languages. So yeah, I guess we're aware that they came from Latin, you know, but we're just aware of it.
It is a pretty, that's an interesting concept that the Romans would be speaking Latin and then would have the, it's really strange to think of. If nobody's ever had that thought before, that the languages are connected, you wouldn't think to connect your language to another language that's not the same language. But at the same time, it's very strange that anyone in the present doesn't know what their own language was 200 years before, you know?
Well, I think it's kind of different when you get to, actually, maybe it's not, but it feels to me like Latin and Greek, when they don't have the same alphabet, it's like, oh, you know, whatever, there was same words, but it's like, well, the people interact, who knows if it's actually from the same source, maybe right. Like there's just crossover words, as opposed to the Romance languages, where by that point they all have the combining factor of church. Mass becomes Latin mass, and so it's like, well, they all have to be aware that their language has connections to Latin, like all these Romance languages. You know, so for them, then it is more so like, okay, you better understand that the languages came from the same source. Maybe you don't care. You know, it's just like, that's that. So like, even with the Romance languages, I feel like we should just use that as like, just like an example here. So like, why did Latin fracture? So Latin was the dominant language of the Roman Empire in the West. So think of Croatia westward. So from North Africa to Britain, everybody spoke Latin. And then in the east of the Mediterranean, so anything east of Croatia, they all spoke Greek. That was the dominant one. Okay.
Greece, Turkey,
even like
Israel.
Judea, Egypt. Yeah.
Okay.
And then the elite class probably knew Latin and Greek. Anyways, the Roman Empire falls because in the West it falls, because the East doesn't actually fall. It just becomes the Byzantine Empire. And that's just the name we call it. They didn't even, they just consider themselves Roman still until like 1400, which is ridiculous. But anyways, so in the West, a bunch of German tribes started moving in, and they usually did learn the local language, but obviously that came with a dialect, and that, you know, there's always a dialect in everything too. So that's not that weird. But then, you know, you can think too, people in 400 AD, like say Saint Augustine, who lived in North Africa and who was fluent in Latin, he could probably understand Augustus Caesar from 0 AD, 400 years before. And that's probably like how we can just barely understand Shakespeare, maybe. Maybe that's what I've heard.
Interesting.
But then overall, you know, obviously there's always dialects everywhere, because I think that's just a part of language, right? But when these German tribes moved in, some of them were hostile, and so like it wasn't as safe to travel anymore, and so everything became way more localized as opposed to like the very specialized economy that Rome had, which is why it was like such a successful empire.
It was very integrated across the entire empire. You could,
yeah,
goods and people and language could move really easily from end to end, right?
Like certain areas would specialize in like pottery making because they could do it the most efficiently, and they could easily ship it to everybody else. Once these tribes started coming in and it was no longer safe, then that stopped, and so everybody had to just go back to buying local. And so from there, when you break up and you don't have contact with people far away, so like people in France were or Gaul at the time were no longer talking to people in North Africa, then it's like, yeah, even though their languages all came from Latin, they don't have anything to do with each other anymore. And so then the dialect starts to really break up. And so that's where it's like potentially somebody in 800 AD in France might have been able to understand what somebody in 400 AD was saying in Latin, but they could no longer understand Caesar Augustus in 0 AD Latin. You know, they can't understand that Latin anymore.
Okay.
Just like we can't, because we can't understand Chaucer either. You know, the Middle English from like 1100 AD.
Although Shakespeare could have understood Chaucer, and we can understand Shakespeare.
Well, so potentially the guy in 400 AD could understand the guy in 800 and in 0 AD, but the 800 guy can't understand the 0, and the 0 can't understand the 800.
Right.
But obviously they're still all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I think, like, the big shift in languages from, like, 0 AD on, I think languages, because Latin and Greek, they're dominated by word ending, you know, to figure out what part of speech it is. But then eventually, I feel like, I thought I've heard, like, the dominant thing just becomes word order, and you just use, you know, most words just have the same ending. I mean, we still have different endings for plurals, like, you add an S, usually. But beforehand, there was, like, 10 different things, like, for if this was the direct object, or if this was the noun, or if this was the verb, you know.
Interesting.
The verb was organically, language just became simpler. Like, now we'll just have an order, and you can just say the same word instead of having to, you know, get the correct ending, you know. So that would probably lead to, like, less grammatical mistakes. Yeah. All right, so that's, like, that's a little example there. Now, it gets interesting in the 19th century, because this is when they realized that languages don't randomly change. Like, there are in quotes laws governing these changes, and this is how comparative philology is born.
Okay.
Philologists could codify the phonological laws by which particular sounds had changed at different stages of a language's history. Now, the most famous of these laws is Grimm's Law. So Jacob Grimm, he was a German in the 1800s, he codified the complex of regular changes that produced, for example, the words pater in Sanskrit, Greek, and Latin. So in the so in all three languages like that, the word pater is the same for the same exact person. Whereas that word in English is father, and then in Old Norse, or no, sorry, Old High German, it's vater. So what he could, so you know, father, vater, and then vater, pater, those sound similar, right? So what he deduced is like all of these have one single unrecorded root in some other language, some more ancestral language.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, okay, so this one was cool too. So Tom Shippey was, and you know, Tom Shippey's going to be, I used a lot of Tom Shippey for this episode, and then John Garth, who wrote the Tolkien and the Great War. Shippey, like, this is his job. Like, literally. And then the Tolkien and the Great War book, that guy focused on how Tolkien developed Middle Earth and high school and college and during the war and stuff. So anyways, Shippey has this example. I thought this one was super cool, so we got to include it. So there's a connection between the word daughter in English and to that in Sanskrit. So the modern Hindustani word for daughter is Beti, I guess. So that's not related, kind of obviously, right? There doesn't look to be any connection there.
Right. between Betty and daughter.
Right. But I guess way back, both had a similar word for milk. So I guess that's both English and Sanskrit had a similar word for milk, and it was dahud, which I don't quite get where that came from in English, but, you know, just go with it for this purpose of this story here. And so in Sanskrit, the word dahutter meant the little milker, you know, of like a cow or something. And this job was completely associated with the daughter who would always do this task. So from there, you know, it must have been that task and the familial relation, you know, like daughter in the family. They must have been fused. And so, like, that's how the words are connected, daughter in English and daughter in Sanskrit, you know, or dahatar in Sanskrit.
Right, right.
Then you got the example. Okay, so if you take the Greek name Johannes, in Latin that becomes Johannes. And then in Italian that's Giovanni. But in French, the Latin Johannes becomes just Jean. And then in Spanish it becomes Juan. In German, it becomes Johann, which you can clearly even see to Latin, or like Hans, you know, and then Slavic, they have Jan, in Russian, they have Ivan, in Basque, they have Jan. That comes to two forms of English, which there's Ian, or Ian, you know, which there's also the Gaelic one of Sean, but in English, we most commonly call it just John. So that's another one, just like you can see all sorts of names, like how they descend out.
Right.
I would assume that name got popular because of the New Testament, which was written in Greek, you know?
Right, right.
So there was a Hebrew or Aramaic form of the name for, you know, the apostle or the John the Baptist. But then, yeah, it became popular afterwards.
And one thing I think we talked about before is how you can kind of reason certain words that have this tree branching chronology type thing that we've been describing existed in the old language and have made their way into these new languages. But there's obviously, like, if a word is a more modern word and it comes up after two languages have branched, then it's basically impossible that you'll find a connection between two different languages for that word, unless one gave it to the other directly through trade or something like that. So that's, maybe we'll see that in other places here, where an example might be car or gun or something like that, like a distinctly modern word that didn't exist in Latin.
Yeah.
Is going to be totally different in all these languages. Whereas a name like John coming out of the Bible, or at least spread by the Bible, is going to have roots and branches in all of these languages.
Right. Garth has this good quote here. He says, "These languages were demonstrably related in ways that were open to rational analysis. Furthermore, by comparing them, it was possible to reconstruct elements of an ancestral language, Indo-European, a language from before the dawn of history that had no record whatsoever. This was heady stuff for Child Tolkien, but it would shape his life." From there, you know, so this is basically like, yeah, if they can now start going back to dead languages, this is a game changer that they can read it, because they have all these, you know, old texts of stuff that's like, we don't know what it says, but now it's like, if we can read this, then it's like, well, whoa, now we can really see what people's lives are like. And so this is like where, you know, this is the next stage in philology, which is, you know, the next thing we're going to cover here.
It feels like, I mean, we've made the analogy that it's like archaeology for language, but it feels so much like this is the moment where, you know, they've finally put together evolution and they're digging up skeletons of dinosaurs, and they're seeing that things are connected to each other, and it's not just like, oh, they're finding random things in the ground and they don't have a way to link them all together.
Yeah, I mean, there's like, it's more, it's harder science than just like the social aspect of it, you know, because there's formulas that work. You know, like they're 100% proven, which we're going to go over. The one that Shippy talks about in his book, and I didn't quite get it, but I think I got it enough to just describe it here, is this eye mutation thing.
Eye mutation.
That's just like the philological law. You know,
it's, and this is like one example. You're saying like mutation of the letter I.
Well, here, let me get into it.
Okay, okay.
So one dead language that they had some texts of was Gothic. And so one of the German, there's actually a couple German tribes that were Gothic. Like there's the Ostrogoths or like the Visigoths and stuff. But anyways, they're one of a bunch of their tribes overran the Roman Empire around 400 AD in the West. And so they had some unreadable Gothic texts at this point. But when the philology methods ramped up, the Gothic and its texts became extremely valuable and vital. It was the oldest Germanic language with any surviving text. Okay, so that means, in theory, you know, you're getting a step closer to Indo-European, you know, which mm-hmm. is like the mother father language of, you know, obviously what it says most, you know, Middle East / Indian languages,
because Indo-European in theory is like this language that's before Sanskrit, before Latin, before Greek, before all right. of those, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we
yeah.
know that before, I mean, those are all old, but before Sanskrit is extremely old.
Yeah, that would imply that there was like a one people that all knew this language. And so I don't know if they lived in a big area, or if like all their people, or if they lived in a small area and all their people spread out as far as India and then all the way, you know, across most of Europe, because most of these European languages fall in Indo-European.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of Indian languages do as well, you know, and everything in between.
Okay.
So also, the fact that this was the oldest German text, Germans like ruled the world for philology. So like they were just more so interested just in kind of themselves, like their own stuff too. Which right. I don't know. You can't really blame them. Whatever. And they're doing the heavy lifting. They can focus on what they want. Plus it's right. in the past, and we can't change it. Okay. Shippey says Gothic exhibited in ways that Old English and High German did not stages in history of all the Germanic languages inferable from but not recorded in its cousins. Does that make sense?
So it's showing, it's because you have another piece of the puzzle, it lets you kind of map this tree further back in time. So he's getting it?
Well, it's an older piece of the puzzle, but then all the rules that come up in Old English and High German, this one also has them and more clearly. You know, like you can make a rule that's like, we're 80% sure this is how it goes in most of Old English and Old High German.
Mm-hmm.
But with Gothic, we're 100% sure on the rule because we see how it changed into those, or like versus how Old English turned into Middle English or Modern English.
Right,
Okay, so one of the rules that they deduced was from Gothic, I assume it's from the Gothic transition into the Old English, is that when an I or a J followed an A or an AI, I,
mm-hmm.
in old English, so this is like the Old English before anything was written down, because mm-hmm. like we have, you know, Old English is like Beowulf stuff, but before that, while it was still just speakers and there was no writing, the speakers began to change the earlier vowel into e or I. Is that how we're saying it? It's that
the AE combo.
Yeah, that one letter, whatever mm-hmm. that's called. Yeah, with similar changes affecting the vowel. Where there is a succeeding I in Gothic, there is a change of vowel in Old English, not otherwise. Okay, so like this is like 100% true in Gothic. And so if you don't understand the intricacies of what I just said there, that's not that important. Just what you have to know is the phenomenon known as I mutation became one of the most familiar horrors in university philology. There is in it something both mysterious and satisfactory. A whole series of things which people said and still say turn out to have one very old but clear 100% predictable reason. It is almost like genetics. No wonder Grimm said the Gothic was a perfect language. Does that also make sense?
I think so. It's kind of suggesting that a linguistic rule, like I'm thinking like kind of like grammar rules in English, but this is a little more. It's not grammar. It's like the grammar within a word, how we modify words. Some of the things we do in English, they've got their origins in Gothic, and the Gothic is even more straightforward with those rules than English is. We know that English isn't super straightforward about a lot of its rules.
Right. English has a lot of exceptions, whereas mm-hmm. Gothic was like, it didn't, you know, and mm-hmm. it was just right on, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, so if they discovered a pattern, that pattern was true 100% through, whereas it's not with English. Because, like, sometimes instead of putting, you know, instead of calling it foots, we call them feet. To pluralize it, you know,
right?
Whereas Gothic, you kind of assume, well, that's kind of a bad example, but Gothic, that the rules are 100%.
Okay.
Also, it's kind of cool at this time too, when Jacob Grimm was doing this, and so this is in, I think, like 1830s, you know, like mid 1800s, philology at the time was cutting edge stuff. Like, of all the soft or behavioral sciences and literature and history and sociology and anthropology, this was super interesting, engaging all of it at the same time, which is kind of sick. Like, that's pretty sweet, you know?
Yeah.
This was the high time of mm-hmm. philology. And so they quickly got good at studying these rules, and they translated everything they had. But when they ran out of these ancient texts, because they did, you know, it's just like we haven't dug anything up, you know, like we don't have anything more. They still had the rules. So then from there, they began to reconstruct and go backwards using their rules that they had had. So from Gothic, we had all these good, clean, 100% rules, right? Mm-hmm. So what we did, so you use like some kind of triangulation, you know, and like when we say triangulation, it's like you have 2 points, you measure the distance between the 2 points, you use rules of geometry, and you can figure out how far away a third point is, you know?
Right. And presumably like they're looking at, they translated all the old Gothic texts, but they also had other old language texts that they translated. And they can look at how those rules are different between the two. Yeah. And use that to kind of map out when was this rule the same in an older language.
Yeah, and so I was trying to just to hammer this home, I don't know, this is actually kind of a really dumb example, but this is what it got. So like, you know, you hear Chicagoans say "da Bears,"
mm-hmm.
Even though we all know it should really be "the Bears,"
mm-hmm.
but using a TH to D rule that I just made up, that's what I'm calling it.
A TH mutation.
Right. So theoretically, instead of saying "the Bears are better than the Packers," Chicagoans you'd think they'd say "the Bears are better than dem Packers." Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I know it was dumb, but it's like
you follow the rule.
Right. So they're using those rules, but instead like they would use the rule to go backwards as opposed to I think I just used it to kind of go forwards or something.
You just applied the rule. But yeah, maybe there is maybe Packers fans have a different strange language permutation, and you could trace it back to a time when Bears and Packers fans were speaking the same language.
Yeah, possibly. Okay, anyways. The philologists used more solid proven rules to go backwards and create asterisk words. So we've talked about these before, but let's just, you know, again, we're just rehashing all this and like giving it its due. It's full due. So these asterisk words, this is extremely weird because they really are kind of just calculating it. Like they're not just, you know, inferring stuff or thinking about it, or, you know, just, it's almost like put it in a calculator, type it out, and it spits out an answer, you know?
Right.
Like you're following, like, you know, you put in A, you get out B based on this formula, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing for this whole thing how mathematical it is.
Right. Well, that's what I'm trying to get across here, is that this is rigorous and, like, proven.
Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy that that's actually true with languages. Like, there's not just random changes that we can't explain. Like, there are some, but, like, you know, they're saying Gothic, there's not many, you know, and this is why it's one of these perfect languages in quotes, you know.
Okay.
So anyways, they're calculating these words that must have existed long ago in an ancestral language, but they don't have proof of it. But, you know, it must have existed. And yet there's still no proof. I mean, it's weird. So, like, the philologist line between imagination and reality, because it's, like, it really isn't imagination that, like, this existed, but they can't prove it, you know, besides that these rules tell you it is. I don't know. The whole of their science had conditioned them to the acceptance of what one might call the asterisk reality, which no longer existed but could, with 100% certainty, be inferred.
Okay.
I don't know. That's a weird way to live. It's cool, but it's, like, a weird way to live.
Right. I see exactly what you mean. They've taken this super scientific approach, and it's given them like an imaginary number, basically. And they're having to move forward with that, but it's all in their heads at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, I think imaginary numbers, that's a good example too.
Like the math says that they have to exist for the formulas to be true, but it's an imaginary number. I mean, like, what are you going to do with that?
Isn't that like, wasn't
the square
that like
root
the square
of negative one?
Right. Yeah. that's I. Yeah. Yeah, that's goofy.
It is.
Well, I don't know. Yeah.
But it's useful in math, and people and mathematicians, it has to exist because they need it to solve formulas. And it's like a,
well, they need those for vectors, right? That's where the most famous.
I think so.
Yeah. Vectors.
Okay.
I think I had a couple classes on that.
Cool.
Okay. All right. Anyways. Now here's the interesting thing. By Tolkien's day, philology was losing steam. Why? Clifford, don't look. Just take a guess.
I'm going to guess that these guys translated the text they had on hand, and they made some predictions about the old languages, and then everything just moved on. you know, other forms of science started learning more about other cultures, and they started gathering information from other places, and they were just less reliant on trying to map out the history of these words with the resources they had on hand.
Maybe that's kind of right, but not quite, I think.
Okay.
Anyways, you tell me if you think you're right, because let's just go over it, and you just tell me if you think you're right, because you're the better judge. Basically, it just became rigorously stale. Like, comparative philology was now just a slog, because at this point, they got so good at it that they had so many laws, and, like, you know, it's also detrimental if you screw up the errors, so it's like you really have to know these laws inside and out.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, they were just following overwhelming amounts of rules, and that was more important than the source material. So basically, it seems like they lost the romance of it.
Mm.
They liked doing this because they liked reading the material, you know, and seeing how it connects to the other material. But now it's just like, no, it's all about the formulas. Like, we know the material. Like, you know, the guys 100 years before, it's like, Jacob Grimm, we figured out the material, and that's that.
It feels like it went from being a tool to try to learn more about history and an old culture and an old language to becoming like mathematicians looking for the next largest prime number.
Or think like baseball, where, you know, everybody's playing the game before, and then all of a sudden, like, the money ball comes out, and it's just like, yes, we can get this down to stats, and it's just like, we just want the guys that are going to get on base, as opposed to, you know, somebody that just loves to play the game, and like, they'll go down swinging and they'll try to get a hit, you know, when it's crunch time and stuff. And it's like, well, no, that guy who's clutch, he's not as important as the guy that's regularly on base, you know? So it's like, it becomes more, I think that's right. Like, you just lose the romance of it. You know, cycling had the same thing, you know, like, they're doing crazy stuff, like drinking weird cocktails at the top of a mountain before they went on a descent, and like they thought it was good to have like a rare red steak on the morning of a big huge race for breakfast. Whereas now it's just like, okay, they're calculating how much watts you can put out and how many watts you think you can hold for this hour-long climb, so that nobody can attack because the pace is going to be too high and they can't sustain it, you know? So it's like, it loses character almost, you know? Because it's just reduced to an impersonal system.
Right.
The discoveries of Grimm and his successors were communicated increasingly to students as facts, systems of facts, systems divorced from the text they had been found in.
Interesting.
Peter Kraft, he's got a good quote here too, which is kind of applicable. He says, it's true that reductionism, reducing the complex to the simple, is almost by definition the ideal scientific explanation. The rules of grammar, chemical formulae, and roadmaps are examples. But to think that reality contains nothing more than the scientific method can know is like thinking that Shakespeare's plays are nothing but exercise in grammar, that the water that endlessly fascinates the poet and the mystic is actually nothing but hydrogen and oxygen, or that the road we actually travel, it has nothing more on it than the map does. So again, he's like, I feel like that quote kind of, it pulls at like, yeah, there's intangibles about stuff as we study it. Like, it's useful what we're doing in the scientific realm and stuff, but it's like, but that's not the end.
Right. Yeah. I guess I come back to like, philology is so interesting as a tool when they're trying to use it to, I guess, to map out the past. And I'm intrigued where there's an intersection of the geography of these movements of ancient tribes and the languages changing and the political struggles of the time and all that stuff. Like what you were describing with the Roman Empire. That's really fascinating. Yeah. Where it's like the language is, you can see the connections between these political and geographic struggles and then words. Like, there's a relationship or a disconnect. And it sounds like philology got to a point where it was, just so reduced down to the math of the letters that it was no longer about this larger picture of history, basically.
Right. Yeah, so just to kind of recap this a little bit, Shippey says, this is why philology had first the old vague sense of love of language, you know, philo is love, ology words, you know, and so that was back in the times when people were just noticing the similarities and they kind of appreciated it, and then it was just like a little hobby to like look into. Then the new 19th century one of the study of texts leading to comparative studies of language leading to the comprehension of evolution. This was like the cutting edge day where they're like, you know, using all their rigorous formulas and stuff and applying it to the first text because they're reading the text and they're figuring out these formulas. Yeah, this was the heyday. Like, this was awesome. And this is like, I mean, I don't know. That is something to appreciate too, that it's just like, I can't believe you can actually get this down to such a good science. Like, it really was good as opposed to, I don't know, I guess some sort of social, lesser social sciences that aren't as, what am I looking for? Concrete.
Rigorous?
Yeah, concrete more so, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 20th century, the specialized meeting within departments of English studies of anti-literary science kept up by pedants like Professor Token, which ought to be stopped as soon as possible. And so this is kind of what most people would think of if they think of like philology today. Like, oh, it's just like...
Unpack that a little bit for me. What does that mean, anti-literary science? Is that, that's what we're describing, where it's like removed from the spirit of the language?
Well, you just have to know all the formulas inside and out. And so then it gets to the point where it's just like, we don't even care about the, like, the literary stuff is just like the side hobby. Like, that's probably why you fell in love with it originally, but now it's just like, when you dig deeper, you don't get back to that love. You just get to a bunch of formulas and formulas and formulas.
And why is Shippy saying he ought to be stopped as soon as possible? Is he just being humorous?
That's what some people think.
Okay.
Like, that was lots of people's view of philology in the 20th century, and they figured Token is in that group that's just like, just follow the laws, you know, just follow
and
those.
They wanted to stop it because they thought it was dangerous or just boring, not useful.
Yeah, they probably did think it actually reached an endpoint, right? Because it's like, mm-hmm. Well, how far back are you going to go? Are you going to reconstruct Indo-European? Are you going to try to reconstruct something else off of that? Or are your rules going to fail you at that point? You know, like,
yeah, because I could imagine people might put up a resistance at some point. Like, yeah, you've learned what you can, and if you push this further, you fully enter the realm of your imagination.
Right.
Like, after a certain point, you're putting more of your own guesses into this thing than the formulas are giving you.
Yeah, because you'd be guessing like, well, what's the most reduced form of these formulas, you know?
Right. Or if the formulas gave you, you know, 1, 2 and then three layers back in this chain or this tree branch type thing, and then you're starting to think about 4 and 5, suddenly you're starting to look at rules based on the second and third levels that were already imaginary, and that at that point you have no real evidence, you know? Maybe it's like you're creating stuff out of the imaginary languages you already worked out.
I mean, Shippy goes on here, though, he's just saying, like, even when you're just studying all those changes, though, like, this is the important thing. Like, when you're studying just those changes, you leave out what he's calling, like, you know, he puts in quotes, like, the spiritual life or, like, the national culture of it. Or to put it another way, according to Shippy, Grimm's fairy tales. With the Grimm's fairy tales part, this is where Token is top philologist, is all about the romantic part of it with the hard science of it too. John Garth in his book, he says, philology, you know, it's kind of like there's a tension between it. It's got one foot in science and the other's in art. You're examining the intimate relationship between language and culture. He says, Token was attracted by both the scientific rigor of phonology, morphology, and semantics, and by the imaginative or romantic parts of story, myth, and legend. As yet, he could not entirely reconcile the scientific and romantic sides, but nor could he ignore the thrilling glimpses of the ancient northern world that kept appearing in the literature with which he was dealing.
Okay.
So Shippy keeps going, philology is not and should not be confined to the study of language. And this is, I mean, Tolkien's going to, what Shippy's saying here, Tolkien 100% wholeheartedly believe. Like, Shippy probably got these ideas from, you know, reading Token's stuff and everything. He says, texts of the old languages are often great works of power and distinctiveness, and any literature that doesn't pay the linguistic toll is incomplete and impoverished. So that's just like a fancy way of saying the translation loses something. You know, like, you're better off reading it in the original text. For a stupid example, like, you can't translate puns. Like, if that was ever something that the translator wanted to get across, you're not gonna, or the original author wanted to get across, the translator is not going to be able to do it.
Right.
So then, on the other side, if you're only looking solely for the linguistic purposes, and you're throwing away the best material, you know, which is, you know, the great power of it, which is why it's lasted forever. And if you're just looking at, like, the linguistics of it, like, how it's changed, just that's straight up kind of boring. Like, you know, this is Shippy the philologist saying this. Like, okay, you know, we could do this all day, but so what? In philology, the literary and linguistic study is indissoluble. Tolkien pushed that they should be the same thing. You should be doing them together in tandem all the time, 100% of the time, which is probably true. I think that's good.
Okay, okay. So he's saying that you have to be
thinking about
the history of grammar and the meaning of the story. You have to be sort of the Renaissance English teacher in a way.
Yeah, I mean it, and you know, like, this isn't really possible. I think Tolkien's like aware this isn't possible for everybody, especially by the end of his career when, you know, nobody was really studying they were probably all studying translations. If they were into the literary aspect of it, they were probably studying translations and stuff. But, you know, Tolkien's aware, like, okay, if we want to really understand the New Testament, we got to read it in Greek, you know, like, he gets that, right? Because the original thing was in Greek. So it's like, if we're going to really, really understand this, we got to read it in Greek. He's not saying you can't read it in English, which is like, I think what they say with the Quran, like, it's not legit unless it's Arabic. I think that would be a teaching of Islam. But, you know, he's not going that far. But it's like, if you want to fully understand it, you got to read it in the original source. And it's like, yeah, I don't think there's any way to even debate that. That has to be true, right?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. And probably like expert translators these days still would agree with a lot of this. Like, the translators who are responsible for translating like full works of literature into another language kind of have to have this mastery that we're talking about.
Right. And like, even the translators, there's big debates about, you know, who captured the essence of it the best. Whereas you don't have that debate if you're just reading the original thing. And like, another thing, like, the whole year I slogged through Dante. And that, it's just like, okay, it was really cool in English and everything, but I don't think I can appreciate the poetry of it at all, because the poetry, I don't understand Italian. And like, that was an Italian work. Like, if you're going to get the most out of it, like, the beautiful language, the highest beauty, you have to read it in Italian. He also thought philology takes you back even beyond ancient text. He used comparative philology to trace words back to asterisk reality. Once you have the asterisk word, then what did the concept or the word mean to that ancient people? So, for example, the English, the Germans, and the Norse all had a word for dwarves. We've talked about this back in The Hobbit, right? And the asterisk word, I guess, would have been Dvergs. Dvergs. Oh, we've had that problem before. Yeah, Dvergs. Dvergs. Okay. So what were Dvergs for this ancient northern people? So, like, the people before the English, the Germans, and the Norse all broke up, what were Dvergs for northern people? Using source text, he tried to answer that. You know, he felt like he was only reconstructing and harmonizing the source text details to recreate the collective imagined world that people who spoke of Dvergs lived in. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So he's
trying to get himself in the head, using their source text and using his philology skills. He's trying to get himself in the head of, like, okay, if I'm somebody that's from Denmark before we all break off and go to England or go down to Germany or go up to Norway, what do I think a dwarf's like?
Right. And maybe he's kind of recognizing that, yeah, we're talking about dwarves. We know these words are connected and we know there's an old word, but we also know these words have slightly different meanings and connotations in each of the modern languages, right?
Since the breakup, yes.
Like, right. Presumably not, no one of them is like the most accurate depiction of this is what a dwarf is.
Right.
And so he's trying to recreate that as well as the word.
Yeah. And this is something that we've highlighted or tried to highlight whenever we could. Like, you know, elves, there's the idea there's dark elves and there's light elves and stuff. And so he's like, well, let me use all of these definitions and ideas and let me just try to make a definition that's going to fit everybody. And that's, so like for the light and dark elves example, he's like, all right, well, all the light elves, they've all seen this really bright light, whereas the dark elves have just been living in darkness, you know, as opposed to like they're some weird, you know, dwarf things, dark elves. They're just elves that haven't seen the light of the two trees in Valinor. You know, that's that's what he, and that fits with the scanty details of these source texts that he would have read. Okay, now this is interesting too. See, I always say that. I always cut out whenever I say that. Like, if I ever say this is interesting too, I've started to just cut that out because, like, well, duh, you're doing the podcast. Anything you say theoretically should be interesting. All right, but anyways.
I probably say that too much as well.
You don't have as many filler phrases as I do. I'm the king of that. But anyways, so some of Tolkien's reconstructing predecessors before him, this Elias Lonrat. All right, he compiled the Kalevala. Okay. Actually, it's pretty important I get this right this time, so I will defer to you. Kalevala.
Okay. Kalevala. Wait, sorry, not to be annoying. I think this is a typo. I think it is Kalevala, the way you said it initially, and it's spelled reversed. The letters are reversed here.
No, because I spelled it the same way.
Take that back. Okay, I've seen it spelled both ways. Wikipedia. I just googled it real quick. Wikipedia and other things I've read call it Kalevala, but then apparently Kalevala is also.
Yeah, they do that with a couple things. Like should be. I forget what else he spells. Just like clearly differently. I don't know, like Woden or Odin.
Uh-huh.
And there's other ones too. Anyways, all right, whatever. Okay, I guess it's not that important. So Kalevala, because I like that one better.
Yeah.
From scattered songs and lays performed for him by many traditional singers. At much the same time, Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm in Germany took up their enormous project of compiling at once a German grammar, a German dictionary, a German mythology, a Germanic cycle of heroic legends, and, of course, a corpus of German fairy tales. That's Grimm's fairy tales. It was these two brothers, these top philologist guys. They were doing this. Literary and linguistic study pursued without distinction, just as it should be. These guys must be Tolkien's heroes because it's like they're combining the scientific part of it, but they're also trying to capture kind of the romance of just studying, you know, the text and the source material in and of itself, you know?
Right.
And they're trying to better understand it by using the science of all those formulas that they developed. There was another guy that did it for Denmark, and there might have been a couple other examples. Anyways, the main point, though, is no one did it for England, and Tolkien wanted to do it. And it wouldn't have been that unprecedented to try. But before we get to that, I just want to talk about the Kalevala a little bit more. Or actually, I want you to talk about it.
Okay.
You want to take that? This quote's from John Garr's book. It was pretty good. Just like I think it really sums up like what the Kalevala is about. So I'm going to let you get it.
This epic poem was the work of Elias Lonrat, collated from folk songs passed down orally by generations of rune singers in the Karelian region of Finland. Fragmentary and lyrical, though the songs were, many referred tantalizingly to an apparently pre-Christian cast of heroic or divine figures, headed by the sage Wainamoinen, the smith Ilmarinen, and the boastful rogue Lemminkainen. Lonrat had seen his chance to create a Finnish equivalent of what contemporary Iceland and Greece had inherited, a mythological literature, and he did so at a time when the Finns were struggling to find a voice. Finland, ruled by Sweden since the 12th century, but entirely distinct in language, culture, and ethnic history, had become a personal Grand Duchy of the Tsar of Russia in 1809. Just then, the notion that ancient literature expressed the ancestral voice of the people was sweeping through Europe's academies and salons. When the Kalevala arrived in 1835, it had been embraced by Finnish nationalists whose goal of independence was still unachieved in 1914.
Should we break this up or should we keep going?
I was just going to say a few little references in there. The reference to Iceland and Greece with a mythological literature. Iceland, we've talked a bit about the Edda, is like this massive epic poem that basically is where we get most of our knowledge of Norse mythology. It's the best like single place that explains a lot of Norse mythology as we think it was in pre-Christian times. And I think people have been able to infer a lot, but that was like one of the few written and long.
But I don't think that's even totally authentic itself either.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm pretty sure it was written by a Christian priest in Iceland.
Yeah.
Trying to record the pre-Christian stories, but it's still a...
And I think even the last copy of it was lost for a couple centuries.
Okay.
Like, we were very lucky to find that probably around this 1800s, 19th century time, I think is when it turned up again.
Okay.
In, like, somebody's, like, barn. It was crazy. Something crazy like that.
Yeah. But anyways, basically a kind of really fundamental critical text for the country tying back to its old mythological lineage. And we can imagine Greece has a similar thing with maybe the Odyssey, the Iliad. Quite a bit of
and
Greek,
all the Greek hierarchy of gods, like right. Zeus and.
But I guess I mean also like all the stories that we have from ancient Greece right. that explain the mythology and the history.
But then what's really key here too, though, is for Finland, you know, he's reconstructing this, but it's not, you know, he's doing this from like the best source material possible, which is, it's kind of like their folk singers mm-hmm. that are still left over in the 1800s and have very little contact with the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
And when he puts this together, this is like a cultural landmark for Finland. What was it saying here? They've been ruled for Sweden for like 6 centuries, mm-hmm. even though they were always a distinct different people. And now they're, you know, they're part of Russia for the past 100 years. And mm-hmm. so this is a big deal. And this is also the kind of thing that influences Tolkien's nationalism views, which we might as well just cover here. So you want to mm-hmm. take that paragraph too?
Sure. Tolkien spoke in defense of nationalism at a college debate that November on the eve of World War I, even as the pride of nations was plunging Europe into catastrophe. Nationalism has carried ever sourer connotations since the 1930s, but Tolkien's version had nothing to do with the vaunting one country above others. To him, the nation's greatest goal was cultural self-realization, not power over others, but essential to this were patriotism and a community of belief. I don't defend Deutschland über alles, which is Germany above all, the refrain in Germany's national anthem, but certainly do.
I think that's what it is.
I'm pretty yeah. sure you're right. But certainly do in Norwegian alt for Norge, all for Norway, he told Wiseman on the eve of the debate. By his own admission, therefore, Tolkien was both an English patriot and a supporter of home rule for the Irish. He could appreciate the romantic notion of language as an ancestral voice, but he went further. He felt that he'd actually inherited from his maternal ancestors a taste and an aptitude for the Middle English of the West Midlands.
That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. That, like, that's it. I think that's about the fairest take you can ever get on nationalism.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I'd say he's pretty ahead of his time. Like, the idea of basically ethnic self-determination, which is what this quote suggests, is becomes kind of like the, I guess, like the progressive standard later on, like post-World War II, when colonies finally start to gain independence from the European colonial powers in great mass, like that's kind of the driving force or the driving philosophy is like ethnic self-determination. Like every people should deserves freedom and deserves to, you know, have their own identity and their own government and control over themselves. And I think things have gotten more complicated since then. Like there's a lot of parts of the world where things are not so straightforward as sort of liberating a colonized people. But definitely it seems like at this moment, Tolkien is way ahead of his time in like calling for that vision of nationalism.
It's pretty clear. And I think even in one of his letters, he says, oh, I love England, but Great Britain's bad. Like, I don't like Great Britain, mm-hmm. you know, and I hate its colonies. Right. You know, like I think there's a letter where he literally does say that almost word for word,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time he still is, you know, he still is clearly like a patriot and proud of his heritage, you know, and it seems like that's kind of tied to the land,
mm-hmm.
I guess the land and the language, obviously,
mm-hmm.
like those are like the two biggest things for the culture, right? Because you got the ancestors, your ancestors on the land, which is what he's feeling the connection to, and then their language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Kind of weird though, because the Anglo-Saxons, like, they're not the most native people to Britain. Like, there were definitely people before the Anglo-Saxons, you know.
You mean that, you know, Tolkien, as we've said many times before, was fascinated with the Anglo-Saxons and loved the English history of the Anglo-Saxons and saw the Norman conquest and Frenchification as like a dilution of the Anglo-Saxon culture?
No, I'm saying the Anglo-Saxons weren't the first ones to Britain.
Right. You know, right. I guess
Romans
I mean
there who they kicked out or wiped out.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. Sorry. I was being long winded, but basically that Tolkien really likes the Anglo-Saxon part of the story, but you can't really take it to its logical end and say he loves the earth of Britain, the land of Britain so much that it's like, whatever's in Britain is what he loves. It's more like he sees himself as part of a lineage that is tied to the land, but it's maybe more about the Anglo-Saxons than it is about the island of England.
Right, yeah, definitely, because he did feel like the Norman Conquest, like, crushed England's national mythology. And you can say England correctly because England comes from Anglo-Saxons, you know, as opposed to Britain's national mythology, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he thinks the Kalevala was, like, a success story for the Finns.
Mm.
Garth has the quote. He says, oh, sorry, this is a quote from Tolkien himself. These mythological ballads are full of the very primitive undergrowth that literature of Europe has on the whole been steadily cutting and reducing for many centuries, with different and earlier completeness among different peoples. I would that we had more left, something of the same sort that belonged to the English. So like that cutting away the undergrowth, you know, like the deep primordial forest that we've talked about before. It's like, yes, like these legends, like the Kalevala, like this is exactly what it's like incorporating, and that's great. But that's all been cut away for England. Like, England's been, like, pruned up and, you know, manicured.
So he's, and probably particularly here, he's looking at this guy, Elias Lönnrot, who was going around Finland in the 1800s, right? To presumably, like, to continue with the woods analogy, like, deep into the forest to people who are disconnected from modernity, telling the old stories. And Tolkien sitting in the middle of the 1900s is like and England,
industrial England,
right, England being a much more modern country, is like, shoot, I wish I could be in that position. I wish I could be going into the deep English forest and finding these stories that were untouched by modern times.
Yeah. And so, you know, and he's looking at all these cultures too, and so this is another thing that he's sensing. He could sense the population. And by population, he just means anybody in the world. They had a taste for philology in all its forms, much more widespread than educators like to think. You know, like, just anybody, it's like anybody can kind of get interested in this stuff. Like, if you actually prompt them, like, people are kind of interested in their own language here. The date of the publication of the Valikala, or of the Kalevala, it remains a national holiday in Finland to this day. Like, they were that, like, totally pumped about this thing, right? Grimm's fairy tales for two centuries enriched the German and international culture. Shippey says, it is not enough for a philologist, the word lover, to be scholarly. The scholar has to transmit his results into life and speech and the imagination of the greater world. Now, what's sad is the misologists. You don't pronounce that first O? Misologists?
You're doing an extra O.
No, I'm doing the first O. Misologists. Oh, wait. Oh, I'm not. I'm making the L a different syllable. Okay. Misologists. Fine. Okay. But there's these misologist guys, which means haters of words. And that's not just like they just hate, like they just don't say like philology is not for me. They're saying they pursued to get rid of philology because they hated it and thought it was a waste of time at universities. These people did win out. Like, if you go, you know, if you go to Oxford now or something, in the academic world, anywhere, you know, in these top universities, you're not going to find philology courses like what Tolkien taught anymore.
So who are these misologists? Why were they so mad? And
they're the people that like to study literature, but they don't want to do the work of going to the source text, I think.
Okay.
Interesting. You know, because they think, like, going to the source text is kind of boring, which is, like, I don't quite know how they can actually just believe that.
These folks are the ones who are like, no, read the translation and do not even bother to learn the original language. We're gonna talk about the Odyssey and Shakespeare in English class, and we're not gonna talk about Old English or Greek.
I mean, they did all love Shakespeare, especially in Tolkien's time.
Okay.
But then again, like, I'm thinking, like, theological studies, like, from the 80s onwards, like, source stuff is just all important. But then again, they all say they're not that well-trained anymore. So, like, there might have been a gap, like, a couple decades gap where these guys totally went out and they didn't do source material translation of stuff.
Okay, interesting.
Maybe that's how it happened. I guess we would have to ask Tom Shippey or something.
Well, anyways, the point is that this sort of course of study and worldview that Tolkien was advocating for didn't end up being very pervasive in universities.
Right. The perfect marriage of the science and the art of it lost out to, I think,
maybe viewing them as separate disciplines.
Yeah, just, yeah, totally separate. As opposed to Tolkien says they have to go hand in hand. They,
right.
The other people are like, no, we don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. But outside the academic world, which you can measure this by the success of Lord of the Rings and the fantasy genre, Shippey says, Tolkien cried out to be heard, and we have still to find out what he was saying. There should be no doubt, though, that he found listeners and that they found whatever he was saying worth their while. Mm. Probably part of the reason that, like, the whole, these mythologists don't even like Tolkien at all. But yeah, because of the success of Lord of the Rings, you know that, like, well, I don't know, this wasn't like a dead end. Like, Tolkien was onto something that, like, yeah, people do care about philology. Like we said, like, mm-hmm. Grimm's Fairy Tales was awesome. The Kalevala is a national holiday, mm-hmm. right, for its publication. And the success of Lord of the Rings and, like, all of fantasy that followed after it, you know, this is proof that, like, yeah, Tolkien, I don't know, it just studying the stories with the mix of words, you know, to give it, like, the depth and the reality.
Yeah, I guess what you're suggesting is that it's part of the appeal of Lord of the Rings is not just that the story is interesting or that there's strange mythological settings and creatures.
Yeah.
But the stories and the language and the characters are linked together in a coherent way that is sort of relevant to other mythology that people know and study and maybe like
understand
in a basic way.
Yeah.
And it's linked within itself. Like, it makes sense the way these different branches have evolved and relate to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there was a good quote. Chippy finished off here. He said, in 1951, Tolkien, and this 1951 is around when he finished Lord of the Rings, but it wasn't published for like another couple years. Tolkien, like Théoden King, when we first meet him, can have had little hope of such success. By his death day, however, he could well have said, like Théoden, when he went to join his philological fathers, even in their mighty company, I shall not be ashamed. Tolkien left a legacy as rich as any of his predecessors. Which is like, that's sick. Nice. You know, like the cool. Grimm brothers is like, they were developing laws and stuff and Tolkien might have messed out on that. But what he did just as much for philology as any of them by, you know, reaching the masses with something that has philology at the heart of it. And everybody loved it, you know, right? Mm-hmm. And so let's get into it now about the heaviest examples, basically, of his philology and like all these laws, especially at work in his whole Middle Earth world.
Okay. So Tolkien said, the invention of languages is the foundation. The stories were made rather to provide a world for the languages than the reverse. To me, a name comes first and the story follows.
Okay. Interesting. So that quote apparently was met with bafflement, which that's probably kind of fair. So Tolkien thought most people could recognize where a name was from without knowing the linguistic history. I don't know. I was trying to come up with examples for us because he gave some British examples, but I was like, I can't connect to that.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, it's like, okay, if you hear the name New Orleans, what? You probably think it's a, you know, it was a French town, right? You know, originally.
Right.
Or like Illinois, it's like, okay, there's a Native American connection there, right? Because it doesn't mm-hmm. sound French, mm-hmm. you know, or it doesn't sound English mm-hmm. for sure, right?
Certainly.
And then he also thought that some languages were more intrinsically attractive than others. So what you can think is like the black speech in Lord of the Rings, that's repulsive. Like what Sauron has, like inscribed on the ring. Remember when Gandalf
said... The language of Mordor?
Right. When Gandalf said the Ashnash part at the Council of Elrond, and everybody's mm-hmm. just like clearly physically disturbed.
Yeah.
You know, so he feels like that's a thing with, it's not that dramatic, but objectively some languages sound better than others
mm-hmm.
is what he would contend. And so Tolkien thought on the reverse side that Welsh and Finnish were intrinsically beautiful. And that's mm-hmm. why these two are going to be the basis for his two most famous languages. He's in this universe, Sindar and Quenya. And because of their beauty, that is why he sometimes puts them in the book without even translating them at all. Like, you figured people could just appreciate that.
That is cool.
Right. That's cool. My push against that is that it's like, well, they're kind of hard to pronounce unless you clearly lay out pronunciation charts for
right.
it.
Right, right. That makes sense. That. Makes sense.
But it's if almost he like
he's letting his love for the language go past his concern for the reader.
Yeah, which, I mean, I don't know. It's admirable. Like, that, I mean, that's, I think we talked about that before, but, like, he didn't write Lord of the Rings for, like, a mass audience. Like, he was pretty surprised that it succeeded. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just like, oh, okay. You know, yeah. Like, yeah. There's been fewer books that have ever been more not written to please people, you know? And one of the only few that tops Lord of the Rings is The Silmarillion, you know?
Yeah.
Because most Lord of the Rings fans aren't even pleased by that one, but unless you're a diehard. Yeah, so another thing to keep in mind, too, is that hopefully we've harped on this enough, but, like, him inventing these languages, this was, like, a distracting hobby in his school years. Like, this actually affected his grades. Like, he did worse in school because he was just spending his time doing this. And, you know, he'd be triangulating, like, the lost Gothic words, you know, like the asterisk words that might have existed. You know, he's 100% certain they existed, but he doesn't have proof, you know? Like, mm-hmm. He was doing that in his free time instead of studying, like, Latin and Greek, which is what they called for in school at that point. And the language building, he was always more artistic with it rather than practical, because he wanted to get the beauty out of it, which is, that's cool. John Garth, in his book, he had, like, just a lot of good information on the first one, Quenya. And so, for context, this is the Elven language that's spoken in Valinor. So this is kind of the equivalent to Elf Latin.
Okay.
So this one, it's based off, or it's shaped by Finnish, and he started this in like 1915. So this is before he goes to war, like mm-hmm. he's in college. And notably, Finnish is one of the four languages in Europe that's not an Indo-European language. Okay, so this one's like pretty different. It felt very remote and mysterious as opposed to like anything else. Like any sort of German or any sort of, I guess, even Slavic or Romance languages, you know?
Yeah, Finnish is just,
they said it's Uralic.
It's related to, I know Hungarian is.
Right, that's also
in the same family, and
they,
I think.
And they said Estonia is.
And they're just totally different from anything. Oh, yeah, that's what it is. Estonian, maybe.
Well, no, it's Hungarian and Estonian and Finnish. They all come from some people that must have been like in like Siberia or like the Urals, you know, that mountain range at the top of Russia.
Uh-huh.
And they're not part of Indo-European people. Who I guess would have been more further south, maybe. Anyways, the only other European language that's not Indo-European is Basque, because Basques are cool. That's like the top center of Spain, and they're just like
right.
They're
just isn't their own isn't people. Basque related to Celtic? Like
it might be
pre-Roman, basically.
No, like way further than that. Like, I mean, it's pre-Indo-European. Like, there was peoples all over Europe before. I think even before the Celts, dude. Like, there's people all over Europe, and then this Indo-European migration came, and they probably wiped out all these people, except the Basques. They were too tough.
Okay.
So, all right, anyways, back to Quenya, though. So, John Garth says, here, the small starky array of consonants and the chiming inflection word endings of Finnish produced a distinctive musicality that Tolkien adapted for Quenya. But he wanted a language with its own past, so he detailed how Quenya had evolved from an ancestral tongue that he soon named Primitive Eldarin. And Eldar, that's just like the word for elves, right? So this is like the primitive version of Quenya. So it's like, he can't just make Quenya, he's got to make, you know, what was its root language when the elves all woke up together, when they first woke up, you know. And we talked about the waking of the elves. All right, anyways,
it's kind of hilarious that he would to make a language would make a different language.
It's not hilarious, it's legit.
It's hilarious if you haven't been paying attention to this, but it makes total sense.
Oh yeah,
on the way that he's thinking about language and history.
Yeah, as in any real world language, the process was a combination of sound shifts, phonology, the development of word-building elements, morphology, like the S or the ES that commonly pluralize the English noun, and development and meaning, which is semantics. So, like, he would have, like, whole notebooks full of, like, just recording sound shifts of, like, from this primitive language to his Quenya that he wants to form. They said he was kind of acting like Jacob Grimm, because Jacob Grimm was actually filling out notebooks of like high old Germanic, old high Germanic to modern German or something, I guess. Whereas, you know, and he was actually doing it, you know, like an observer looking back at unrecorded stuff, but nonetheless like real past, you know. Whereas Tolkien, you know, he was kind of just artificially doing this, but he felt and acted like he wasn't artificially doing it.
Right.
he feels like he's being the just the observer trying to get back to it, but I mean, in actuality, he's not, as this quote highlights here.
In practice, though, Tolkien also played God, or sub-creator emulating the creator, as he would later have put it. He did not just observe history, he made it. Instead of working back from recorded evidence to reconstruct the lost ancestral roots of words, as Grimm had done to arrive at a picture of ancient Germanic, he could invent primitive Eldarin roots and move forward, adding affixes and applying sound shifts to arrive at Quenya. Furthermore, Tolkien could change a sound shift law, and sometimes did. Because each law should apply across the language, this might entail alterations to any number of words and their individual histories. Revision on that scale was a painstaking process, but it gave Tolkien a perfectionist's pleasure. There was a scope here for a lifetime's tinkering, and he used it.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah, so sure, he can act like a recorder and, you know, function like that, like the scientist observing the changes, but he gets the best of both worlds because he gets to be the scientist too. You know, like he's just the one, like, I get to make up whatever the rules are. I get to make up what the original forms are. And if I want something to come down better into my Quenya to perfect that, I can just change the rule. That means I got to change every single word that followed that rule. But that's fine. I'll do that because it'll be worth it. You know, it's just like that's a fun task for me. So it's like, yeah, why not? I'll just do it. I want the best. You know, I want the 100%. I want the A+.
Yeah. On the one hand, it feels like it's like the ultimate philology assignment. If he had a philology teacher in school at this time, and they were like, for a dissertation, you have to invent a language and apply everything we know about philology to creating a language. It sounds like that's what he's doing right now.
Yeah, I think nowadays in lots of universities and stuff, if they're studying languages like this, they use him as like a practice.
Interesting.
They use these as practice, apparently.
Okay, that's very interesting. I was going to say, on the other hand, though, I wonder, did it discredit him ever with any of his contemporaries that he was basically diving off in the realm of the imaginary?
Well, that was like when Lord of the Rings was published, they're like, really? How much time did this take you? You know, as opposed to, you know, work, right?
Right.
Like real work. And so it's like, I mean, that's been the big question is like, well, did his academic discoveries or breakthroughs or studies suffer from, you know, devoting all this time to like a mythical thing? Yeah, in an academic context, probably. But like what Shippey was saying with that Théoden quote is like, by producing Lord of the Rings, he still did like as much as any other great philologist before him because it wasn't an academic breakthrough, but it was a breakthrough for everybody to just appreciate philology as it should be appreciated, like the science and the art working in harmony to produce something that seems totally real, even though it was just artificially done. You know, like this is the best artificial example you're ever going to get. Does that make sense? This really gets just like so much fun and really cool. Like, because he's, you know, he's the sub-creator, he's, you know, playing God, and he can just do what he wants here. Like, so just, you want to read this quote about some of the examples of stuff that he does?
Sure. If these austere sound shift laws were the scientific formulae by which Tolkien generated his romantic language, and essential to its personal character as DNA is to our own, inventing Quenya was also an exercise in taste, as heartfelt as any art. Tolkien's sound pictures were always acute. The bassy Kalongalan, ringing or nailing of large bells, and its alto counterpart, Kilinkele, jingling of small bells. The elegant alternations of Vasivaswe, for beating or rushing of wings, or the tongue-twisting Patak Ata Pakta, Ratatat. Quenya is more than onomatopoeic, though. Nang, I have cold, or meek, a kiss, pronounced more or less as meekwe, mimic what the speech organs do when your nose is blocked or your mouth is amorously engaged.
Of Does course, that make sense? Like, nang? It should be
more it's like, it's like you're, it's nasal. It's like your nose is pinched.
Yeah.
Nang.
Yeah.
And then,
or like meekwe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Of course, most concepts have no intrinsic connection with any particular sound or mouth movement. Tolkien tried to match sound and sense much as an expressionist painter might use color, form, and shade to evoke a mood. Derivation aside, only taste dictated that Fumalot means poppy, Aresia means lonely, or Morwen, daughter of the dark, signifies the glimmering planet Jupiter.
Does that all make sense?
It does. It's really interesting.
He's being artistic over practical with the language. Because in reality, like languages, nobody gets to decide what words mean unless you artificially create it like Tolkien does. Like in reality, you know, like a whole people, like language evolves and it's like nobody's deciding the rules of it.
Right.
And so like, yeah, it's probably based on like practical stuff for however they're speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But Tolkien, since he is doing this artificially, he gets to have fun with it. So like some of the words is just like, yeah, they're like the onomatopoeia crap, or it's just like, you know, like literally mimicking sounds of, you know, what your mouth would do when you say these words.
And on the other hand, though, it points out, though, that he is being practical in certain places where he does, there's words that just come to be because of the rules that he set up.
Well, that's the whole point, is like, and it, if he wanted to change the word in Quenya, he would have to change the rule, which is what he does sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So he is practical in that it doesn't just come out of nowhere and break a rule to, like, have a word that he wants. It's like, but he derives the word by the rules that he sets up himself, so it feels legitimate, but then it still has all the high artistic stuff that, like, language that has nobody governing it could do ever.
You know? Right. Crucially, Tolkien used Quenya to create a world like our own, yet unlike. Its trees are ours, but their names make them sound as if they are on the verge of communication. The laburnum is Lindelochte, singing cluster, while Sigilise, weeping willow, also means lamentation itself. This is a word of Austa and Yelin, summer and winter, Lisele, Pikele, and Pikise, sweetness, bitterness, and grief. But enchantment courses through Quenya, from Kuru, magic, wizardry, to Campo, the leaper, a name for Arendelle, and to a whole host of other names for people and places that emerged during a couple of years' work on the lexicon. For Tolkien, to a greater extent even than Charles Dickens, a name was the first principle of story making. His Quenya lexicon was a writer's notebook.
All right, that's pretty cool too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I have much to add to that one.
Yeah, same. I've never heard of Dickens being one who is so keen on the significance of the name before, but it's an intriguing comparison.
You know, obvious examples that, yeah, Tolkien was the king of that. Mm-hmm. Just from doing all this. Now, okay, so here's one last interesting one about Quenya, is sometimes he uses Quenya to give artificial explanations to our own world. So that might not make sense, but let me just give this example of it, and maybe this will help make more sense. Philologists have derived the Greek and Sanskrit word for axe are palikus and paruso from a lost non-Indo-European source. Okay, so both those languages, they have the same root, but that root comes from some outside language outside of Indo-European. Okay, so it was introduced to Indo-Europeans, but Indo-Europeans didn't come up with it because maybe Indo-Europeans didn't invent an axe, I guess, right? Maybe that would be the thought. But anyways, Tolkien, he just decides to rediscover the word, you know, in quotes, and that source is the Quenya word pelico.
Okay, so he's almost like playing a game a little bit where he's...
Yeah, he's just like, all right, we don't know where the Greek and the Sanskrit word for this comes from, so I'll just say they got it from Quenya, you know, like, let me just fill in that gap, you know, like, that's what I'm doing here with the... Kind of cool.
Very.
Hopefully that gives you a feel for what Quenya is like, right? I think we went pretty in-depth with that. Now, the other famous one is Sindar. And so if Quenya was like the elf Latin, this is the elf Greek. And so, like we said, this one's based on Welsh.
Okay.
So now Welsh, he's had a longer connection to probably than Finnish, because he originally really liked Gothic, but then he found the Kalevala, and he's like, oh, this supplants my love of Gothic. And so it's like, I'm all about the Kalevala. But, you know, eventually he'd always had this connection to Welsh because since he was like 8 years old, he would see trains passing through Birmingham and they'd be coming from Wales. And so like he'd be reading like the names of these coal cars and stuff, and he'd be hearing like this weird Welsh language. And Welsh is a weird language. Tolkien's saying it's super beautiful, and I'm not going to disagree with him, but it's like... It's different, dude. Like, it's strange to think that comes from the English that, you know, United States American English is derived from. You know?
Like Wales is
Welsh is like Gaelic, right?
Well, they have a bunch of Y's and W's and R's, you know, like it's crazy. But anyways, for this one, let's fast forward to when Tolkien, he's in the hospital bed in 1917 after he's coming out of the trenches. So he's already been in the war. So at this time, this is when Sindar, which at first is kind of called, he calls it Gnomish, and the gnomes being the precursor to the Noldor. So originally his idea was like, this is going to be the Noldor specific language, or the gnomes at that time. And we've heard all about the Noldor, obviously. So it'd be a language not for the people in Valinor, but for the people back in Middle Earth. Because, you know, we kind of know from the story, the gnomes go to Middle Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Sindar doesn't end up quite being for the Noldor, as opposed, but it does end up being for the people that are back in Middle Earth, not from Valinor.
Okay.
And so he's got this great quote here, and this is just like, this is one of the best quotes we're going to do in the whole show. This is one of a handful that really, really, really took my breath away, that it's like, wow, that's such a cool connection, such a cool, interesting idea. This author, John Garth, did such a good job picking up on that. And it's so interesting that, like, Tolkien got this deep into it, even if it wasn't even fully conscious. Anyways, let me just read it because it's awesome. Okay. Tolkien had been gathering himself for a spring. Probably while still in the hospital, he made a new list of Quenya words drawn from his lexicon, calling it the poetic and mythological words of Eldarissa, another name for his language. Halfway through, he interrupted it with a chart of Desnians of Faerie, in which every Quenya word is translated not only into English, but also into a second invented language, Gnomish, which is more, you know, Gnomish is just another word for what's eventually Sindar. In accordance with the historical linguistics, his academic specialty, Tolkien had derived Quenya fictively from an older ancestral language via a series of regular sound shifts and word-forming affixes. He created Gnomish, or Sindar, Quenya's sibling, by filtering the same originating language that primitive Eldarin that we had talked about, through different sound shifts, sometimes also applying different morphological elements. This principally is how German and English have grown out of the language spoken in common by the Germanic peoples in the first centuries AD. So let me just stop there, just make sure that's clear. Is that clear?
Yeah, it's really cool. They have the same root, basically.
Right, and then when you have a body of water separating you, like you do with England and Germany, mm-hmm. or like when you have Valinor and Middle Earth,
mm-hmm.
there's always rules that, you know, that they follow to change stuff, mm-hmm. but the rules aren't the same on both continents.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's what they're saying.
Yeah, it's just you change the parameters. It's once again, right. like the kind of perfect philology homework, or the perfect thesis right. experiment, is he's tweaked the parameters of everything, and an entirely new language has emerged.
All right, so now here's the key part. This is the part that, like, just blows me away. And again, remember, he's doing this in 1917 after he's gotten out of the trenches. Tolkien, however, followed his heart, not his head, by finding the inspiration for his two invented tongues in a pair of real-world languages that are utterly unrelated. Just as Quenya reflected Tolkien's passion for Finnish, so Gnomish, or Sindar, reflected his love of Welsh. Quenya liked trailing vowels, but Gnomish / Sindar forgot them. Quenya favored the hard, voiceless stops, k, ta, pa, but Gnomish, Sindar, followed their softer voiced counterparts, g, da, ba, to flourish. The names of the Finnish and Welsh national myths, the Kalevala and the Mabinogion, illustrate the characteristic well. Aesthetically, Sindar sounds as if it has been worn smooth by change and experience, as befits a tongue spoken in exile among the fading woods of our mortal world, in contrast to Quenya, spoken in stately, immutable Valinor. It seems apt that Quenya, the language of lore, had been devised when Tolkien was an undergraduate and a soldier in training, whereas Sindar, the language of adventure, tragedy, and war, should emerge after the Somme. Isn't that cool?
Very.
I thought that was just one of the coolest ideas and best connections I've read in any of the books I've studied for this.
Yeah, it's just such
that was awesome.
Such a well, obviously he's ridiculously talented to be able to do this in the first place, but then the fact that he's connecting two completely different languages and they have bearing on the context of what they relate to within Lord of the Rings, and they kind of relate to his own experiences And it all, yeah, it's all connected.
And the experiences within his story itself, too. Like, what you were getting at, like, you think it's interesting when, like, politics or, like, history changes the words and stuff. It's like, well, this is literally true. It's like, okay, when they were in Valinor, they spoke this nice, high, you know, sterner, more regimented language, you know, like the Latin kind of language, the Quenya. But then when they came back and they fought through all these wars and everything, you know, like they've been worn down and smoothed out, you know, like they're not, they're like the smooth rock that's under the river, like how it gets, how the water just like crushes it down so that it's not spiky or jaggy anymore. Yeah, I thought that was just excellent. That was so cool.
Agreed.
Yeah, I don't know. This is just something that both these languages, he would make refinements and stuff like throughout his whole life. For example, the tongue of the gnomes, commonly formed, now it's commonly formed plurals by vowel mutation rather than adding like a suffix, like as in English for some of our words like foot and feet, you know, and to pluralize it, we just change the vowels as opposed to putting on the S, you know. So he was making all sorts of changes like that to both the languages for like the rest of his life.
Cool.
In Lord of the Rings, if you're wondering, the names of Gondor, which we haven't gotten to yet, and most of the, and like all of the elf places, they're in that Sindar language, so the one that's based on Welsh. Now, you know, what it eventually became was the Noldor, you know, who were the gnomes originally, as you were shaping it, and the Silmarillion. They still remember Quenya because that's what's spoken in Valinor, but they pick up Sindar when they come back to Middle-earth because that's the tongue that was spoken where they were. And that's like, you know, that's a practice of basically any immigrant anywhere. Like, they usually pick up the native language, right? So, yeah, not always, and then that actually usually kind of leads to a new group coming in. But yeah. So whereas the Hobbit language, you know, it sounds like they're kind of just, they kind of speak just modern English. And then the dwarves, they were more so based off like old Norse stuff. And then the Riders of Rohan, I think we're, oh, well, we haven't gotten to them yet because this is going to come out before we do Two Towers. Anyways, they're more like old English, as you'll see. And these distinctions, I mean, you know, the ones between the Hobbits versus the Dwarves versus the Riders, those should be pretty easy for the reader to tell that, yeah, these aren't Elf Sindar stuff, you know, or any some sort of Elf language that they have in Gondor with the Elves. But what is hard to tell still is how many readers would have picked up that the All Elvish song in Rivendell that they didn't even bother to translate, that one was in Sindar, but Galadriel's Farewell song in Lothlorien, which he also didn't bother to translate, that one's in Quenya. You know, like, okay. That's hard for people to tell. Maybe it wouldn't be if we were looking for it, though. Potentially. I don't know. That would be the interesting thing.
Right.
Like, if I didn't, maybe I just screwed up a game. We could have played a game if I could have had you go read them and you tell me which was which, but oh well.
Stop. I am curious now. I would like to go back and look at them, but
yeah, well, we could probably find stuff on the internet. Well, I don't know. We could dab that on or something. No, actually, we can't because we're not going to put an ending on this. Anyways, all right. Then, now to confuse everybody even more, and I'm really not going to touch it, if you want to read more about this, because Tolkien still, there's even like another level of translation that like I get it, but I can't, it's such a headache to try to explain it. If you want to read more about that, I just want to mention it just to say that I did so that I can say that I understand this stuff. Go to pages 116 and 117 on The Road to Middle-earth by Tom Shippey, and you can see how Tolkien felt like he was a translator, because he's like, you know, he's basically saying is like the Hobbits is like he's translating into English for us. It's kind of dumb to just assume like they would just be speaking English.
Okay.
You know, I don't want to get into it, so I just want to mention it. Pages 116, 117, Road to Middle-earth.
Okay.
All right. And then the only thing I have to finish it off, too, is just to recap, or not really recap anything we've done, but just highlight, like, obviously, words important to Tolkien. You know, he thought they were extremely beautiful, and, you know, we didn't get into it in this episode, but, like, foundational, too. Like, you know, when he would read, like, the first lines of the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, you know, like, the Word is like, yes, this is the foundation of, like, everything. You know, this is how God creates the world, kind of, too. So it's like he definitely felt all sorts of connections to that. And, you know, we see that most especially in all his proper names. Like, they're beautiful and foundational. This is probably why everything has multiple proper names, because he loved it so much that, you know, like, he had all these languages and stuff, and it's like, oh, you know, we gotta have three names for all these mountains and stuff, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I think just that last quote that Peter Grape has here could kind of probably finish this episode off well. You want to just take that?
Each word in the Cimmerillion seems like a thunderbolt from heaven, a miracle. There are many capital letters, in contrast with the fashion of our leveling, reductionistic age to trim, to decapitalize, to decapitate. And there are many nouns, both common and proper. It is the Anglo-Saxon style. The words are solid, like mountains, heavy and slow, like a glacier. The sense of height and weight of words suggests the sense of ontological height and weight, a verticality, supernaturalism. The reader is lifted up out of himself into immense polar skies, into the realm where great syllables of words that sounded like castles came out of his mouth.
Mm. Awesome. That's about all I got.
Mm-hmm. Good work.
Yeah, I think this was fun. Yeah, this was also not as long as I thought it would be, or hoped. I don't know. Came out kind of like a normal length one. So.
Yeah?
Yeah. All right, well, yeah, nice job, Clifford. This was awesome. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah.
We'll be back soon with Two Towers content.
Okay. Thanks, y'all.